ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan, on what should have been day four of the Boxing Day Test. Instead, some 43 hours on, we are sitting here in the studio doing our weekly Monday debrief. My name's Corbin Middlemass in Melbourne, where it is like 35 degrees today. It's a hot one outside, and Ed Cowan is in Sydney, my podcast co-host. Hello, Teddy.
Corb, 35 degrees, day four, perfect conditions for a little bit of up and down, maybe some late turn, maybe a little run chases on the cards later today. I'm excited for that. Oh, hang on. No. Been twiddling my thumbs for 48 hours, wondering where the cricket is. What have your reflections been? 48 hours on.
I was at the... That's a good question. I was at the MCG yesterday. We did grandstand from there, so I got the pulse of the people. We took some talkback calls. I think we got about 18 across the 3 hours of the program. I also attended Matt Page's press conference yesterday, which was – that was a weird old experience, I must admit. I got the chance to head down to the Test Fest, as they call it, at Yarra Park and chat to three of the Aussie boys, including Cam Green, your man Jai Richardson and Mitchell Starc. So I spoke to all of them about the scenario. So I feel like I've canvassed a lot of opinions. We'll start with Matt Page. I thought he handled it as well as he possibly could. Like I was fascinated as to how it was going to unfold. I thought there's only two things he can say here. One, he walks out and does the, you know, Sourav Ganguly, which we spoke about from a few weeks ago, ahead of that, they tested Eden Gardens. And he basically says, this is the pitch we were told to prepare. We got instruction that this is what we're going to do, which was very unlikely he was going to do that. And the only other option, as you outlined the other night, was that he threw himself on the altar. And that's what he did. He basically said, hey, these are the reasons for it. He talked about the weather in Melbourne. Of course, the famous Crowded House song about the four seasons in one day. The cool weather leading up where the temperature hovered around the mid-teens. And then for days three and four of the test, it would spike up to the mid to low 30s. And so as a result, he felt like, as the test progresses, given the fact that it's not going to crack up, there's not going to be sort of the variable bounce, that basically he needs to do something to assist the bowlers. And so that was to leave the extra grass on it. That's why there was 10 mil as opposed to 7 mil, which we saw last year. I guess the only counter to that would be, that the teams clearly knew. I mean, the Aussies didn't pick a spinner. It wasn't like they were planning to, for this game to go deep into days three and four. And I think Matt did all he could do was basically put his hand up and say, hey, we got it wrong. He's got plenty of people defending him, as he should, saying, hey, he's got a pretty good track record to bring life back into this pitch. But this was, I think, as Ben Cameron put it, this was 10 mil that cost 10 mil.
Good line. I mean, I caught a little bit of the presser, and it felt like it was almost he was being prosecuted. And I'm unsure that we're in the business of prosecuting groundsmen when it comes to cricket pitches.
So the only thing I would say is everybody had opinions on it leading in. And coming out of it, I feel like everyone thought, okay, I can understand how we got there. You got the team basically saying, oh, I think Andrew McDonald mentioned it was a bit of an outlier. It sort of feels like, look, I can understand how we got to that point. The big takeaway from the press conference, and this was referenced both by Stuart Fox and by Matt Page, there's a lot of scarring there from what this pitch used to be in 2017. And they referenced that test match where, Alistair Cook batted longer than this entire test lasted. And so as a result, they've basically, Matt Page has been given this brief, we're never, ever going back there. We're not doing that again. And so we've seen these pitches that have had more life in recent times. And you use the Goldilocks analogy from time to time on this podcast, Teddy, and it feels like if they need to err one way or the other, they'll err on the side of the bowler as opposed to the side of the batter. What I would say is I actually think that past trauma and that, standpoint has cost them big time here, because if ever there was a test match in any series where the Ashes have already been retained, this is a fill-up. Cricket Australia need, the coffers need to be filled. It's Boxing Day. People want to follow along with the cricket. If ever there was a way to err one side or the other, this was the time to err on the batting team. And maybe because of the brief that he's been given and the history of the MCG and the criticism they copped in the past, that's partly contributed to the balls up that we've got at the moment.
It's a super fine line, though, of this kind of top-down overlord of Cricket Australia, like the BCCI would, and as you described, saying, hey, guys, we want this test match to go 4 days or 5 days. We actually don't care what the outcome to get there is. Just make sure that happens. And then you start meddling with different venues. You know, Kriegstrat doesn't own the infrastructure. It's just it's an interesting conversation. I think Kriegstrat is obviously woven throughout those conversations in the lead up, but they're never as explicit as that. And so it would be a change of tact for someone to kind of come in and say, hey, let's do 5 mils. I know 7 mils was kind of cool last year, but let's do five and see what happens.
But it's in every stakeholder's best interest that that went days, isn't it? Like even like Matt Page works for the MCC, doesn't work for Cricket Australia.
Yeah.
But it's in the MCC's best interest that it goes days. I mean, I don't know. It's almost like they're so scared that they're going to end up with this dull draw that they'll do anything they can to avoid that happening. I don't know. I feel like, you know, with modern batting techniques and everything else, the free-flowing scoring ways that these two teams play, it's very unlikely you're going to get a draw anyway. Mm. And England have proved that. They've played 46 games under Brendan McCullum. They've had two draws and both of them were rain affected. So I don't know. I liked his approach yesterday. You asked – sorry, I feel like I've rambled on about this other point and haven't really answered your initial question. Our English colleagues in the press think it's hilarious. Like that the curator even has a profile and does, you know, media leading into a test match, let alone coming out of a test match. And that's exactly what it felt like yesterday. It was as big a media throng for any sort of stand-up press conference I've seen for a little while. And yet we were all there thinking, this is a bit ridiculous. We're about to hear a guy come in and talk about the pitch and the grass and whatever else. And yet we were all fascinated as to what he had to say. And so I guess it kind of met the interest levels that everybody woke up on Sunday morning thinking, how on earth was that possible? And so I actually felt that the MCC handled it in the best way they possibly could, and I felt like we wanted to hear from him, and we did.
Mm. And what about the 18 callbacks that you did, just the pulse check on the wider public? Because, you know, for me, in many ways, and we probably say it every year, the Boxing Day test is a little bit of a public bellwether, if you will, for the health of Australian cricket. I actually think, and this is my reflection, this test was a bellwether of the future of test cricket. And I think people all of a sudden have that dot on the page that they can point to and say, test cricket's in trouble, folks. If that, and you know, pitch aside, that yes, there's great interest, but if you can actually point to that dot and it felt like this test match was it, I think people are kind of running around a bit frantically thinking this joyful thing that has brought me so much happiness over the years is at risk. And maybe you kind of had that sentiment pulled apart through your callback or not.
We had one woman who rang us, Angela, who was emotional about it. You could, she was fighting off tears, chatting to us about the state of the game and what this, you know, her favourite sport's going to look like for years to come. And I just want to play you one little piece of audio, Teddy, from a woman named Janine, which I think will probably sum up the sentiment.
I'm all for burning the veils and stumps of this test match, and we can put them in an urn and call it the death of test cricket. And I don't know what I'm going to be watching in the future, because I can't see test cricket existing for a lot longer if we keep going down this path.
So there you go, Teddy.
There you go. And just, I mean, that was not a cue up. I mean, that's just the general sense I get. And maybe this is the moment that people have woken up, because we've been banging the drum for 10 years on this. And for the groundswell of public emotion that I'm sure people are experiencing, maybe it is the actual catalyst for some kind of change. I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's, I mean, what, twice in the series so far. The other thing, we keep talking about two-day test matches. This was different to Perth, though, wasn't it? Like
totally both different short experience. Test matches. I think in Perth, because the wicket is so foreign, you expect it to be a short test.
Yep.
And so you kind of condition that the tourist first test of the year, they're always going to struggle, the pace, the bounce, get your hands ready in the slips. You know, it's almost a cricket cliche. Melbourne, not so much. You know that, you know, if you can get going, you can score some big runs. All those centuries of yesteryear that we kind of still regale, you know, they're still etched in the memory, the history. That's not, you know, you don't have two-day Boxing Day tests. That's not a thing. And so I think it caught people off guard. And, of course, just to kind of keep pulling this thread, you know, the irony is, having lost, I don't know, maybe let's call it 10, 8 to 10 mil on this test, 5 in Perth. The irony really is that this puts a lot of pressure on the privatisation of the Big Bash. And you know what that does? That accelerates all the issues that we're talking about, and the sanctity of Test cricket is further at risk when that happens. And so we're going to have to work harder to ensure that the incentives for players, you know, align to a holistic kind of view across hopefully two formats. You know my views on ODI cricket.
Yeah.
It's going to be bloody hard when you have a private owner who's pushing a whole range of other interests to protect, you know, the test team and also the rights around international cricket, because that's what drives media rights at the moment in Australia, not so much around the world.
Yeah.
What it drives here, and that's what pays the players. That gets inverted. It's not a slow, slippery slope. It's a snowball from there down the hill.
Yeah. That's your kinetic energy. It's just
there we go. And I don't want to be a doomsdayer.
But it's kind of pretty easy to join the dots out
and see where it goes.
Correct. You also can't put your head in the sand. And this is, you know, I pondered that a lot overnight too, where I thought, well, how did I feel leaving Adelaide? And I felt like that was awesome. It was a great test match. Hopefully we get more of the same. And yet you kind of, having two of them now in a four test span, you kind of think, gee, this hasn't been the series that we hoped it would be, as much as, you know, it's awesome for the Aussies and they've won and everything else. And yeah, even for England winning, it didn't feel like, you know, because it was almost a bit of a lottery and the whole thing became, you know, a crapshoot. You thought, it didn't feel like it felt hard to focus on the cricketing side of it when so much of the focus was on everything else, as you said, the broad future of the game, the pitch, the way it was prepared. One thing, just before I move totally on from Matt Page, he did mention yesterday that, you know, the game has changed and we need to change with it, basically alluding to the fact that, hey, you know, maybe that when he was pressed on, you know, batting techniques, and obviously he was, you know, he's very well media trained, so he sort of knew, you know, he's not going to throw any shade on the batters or anything like that, and there'll be plenty of other people that will do that for him. But I'd be surprised if we get something that spiced up in the future. I mean, it feels like there's a lot riding on Sydney in terms of, you know, people's overall enjoyment of the series. I know a lot of the broadcasters have a lot at stake that, you know, when it comes to advertising revenue and everything else, that, you know, we've had 13 of 20 days. There's a lot of pressure to make sure that this goes, you know, at least 4 days in Sydney to make sure that, you know, that they're able to get out of it in the way they need to. And the other thing that which we need to keep reminding ourselves of, this is meant to be the year where everybody eats. This is meant to be the big summer with India coming for the white ball games, England here for the Ashes. You know, it will never get bigger than this. And yet this is going to fall short. And then get ready for the Kiwis, who, you know, barely ever win here. And have struggled miserably across the ditch. And after that, it'll be Sri Lanka and Pakistan. Like, it's three summers away after this before we get the might of India or England back again.
Are we packing up the microphone for a couple of summers and coming back for it for when India turn up in 2028, whenever it is? We might be away tours only. We could be the greatest tourists.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, the away tours are awesome. Like, that's going to be great, but that doesn't really help Cricket Australia financially, does it? The fact that we're going to go to South Africa, we're going to go to India, and we're going to go to England with World Cups in between in the subcontinent and in Africa across the T20 and the 50 other versions of the game. But, yeah, gee, that's, it's not good. It's not good. So I don't want to tip you into it here, because I know you've got the dual roles, obviously, with your role on New South Wales cricket, but getting back to your point about the BBL and accelerating some of those conversations and everything else, what are some of the things that have to be worked through? So we keep hearing, we got to work through it with the states. And Todd Greenberg told me on day one in Melbourne that decision will be made in the first quarter of 2026. And it was still an if as to whether they were going to sell the teams or not. I think we feel like that's going to lean that way. But what are some of those things that need to be sorted out? I mean, clearly the revenue distribution is going to be one as to where that money goes and what that looks like and how it's going to be sustainable going forward. But we're talking about schedules and windows and stuff, aren't we, as well? Because clearly if we're going to sell these teams, we need to have our frontline players available to play in it the same way they do in India and in South Africa now, where, you know, there's no more Boxing Day test. Everybody's available to play for their, you know, largely IPL-owned SA20 teams.
Yeah, so that last point that you just raised is probably more of a friction point for the future owners, not the current owners of the teams. So I'd say the current discussion items, I guess, as you work through the agenda is what you laid out first. And that is, what are you going to do with the money? You know, you can't say that Cricket Australia has been a great steward of capital over the years. And so, you know, the states are well within their rights to say, well, hey, how is this not just going to be distributed back to us, and the current distribution model obviously needs to change, but what does that look like going forward? Because there will be a surplus, and some of that money needs to be put aside to actually turbocharge the Big Bash to make it a better product so that you can get Hive media rights value in the future, which can then flow back to the game, how much is going to grassroots. So they're the kind of big ticket items. And then, of course, there's some lesser points, like two states have two teams.
Yep.
What do you do with those, and how do you disperse money from the sale of those teams, either wholly or in a minority sense? Because, for instance, the Melbourne Renegades, let's say, someone buys them 100%. Don't know if that's on the table, but I'm just kind of playing this out hypothetically. Do Cricket Victoria get all that money, or does that get spread equally through the states? So that, I mean, that sounds like a, oh, that shouldn't be too hard to work out. This is a team that has been run by Cricket Victoria, a team that they have poured resource in. There's brand equity. So they have built this team and poured a whole range of resource into it. There is an argument to say that they should get, you know, maybe a majority of the funding that flows, or maybe all of it. But then if you're sitting in Perth, you're like, hang about.
Yeah.
That's so not fair. You've got two teams and now you're double dipping. And so you can see these kind of conversations flowing through. And so the hat that everyone needs to put on is what is best for cricket, not just what is best for me.
Yep. I mean, my opinion on it, I'm a little more of a neutral as a native sandgroper that now lives over here. I absolutely think that those teams should get the majority of that share. They've had to run it somewhat to their disadvantage at times where they're players splitting across two different franchises, and now that it's up for sale, absolutely. Plus the other thing is too, there's a reason they have two teams, and the reason for that is because the majority of the population lives in those two states. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking at future development of cricket, that's where the majority of our cricketers are going to come from. I mean, it's basic mathematics that there's a reason for that. So but then again, you could argue, well, that also by nature of the fact that they're based in Melbourne and Sydney, they're two cities that ring bells around the world in a way that, perhaps Hobart doesn't, for example, or Adelaide or Perth or whatever. And so, maybe they won't be worth as much anyway. And then you've got two teams that are probably going to be worth more than just about any of the others combined, based primarily on the place in which they're located.
Yeah. And of course, you got to remember we're talking big picture stuff. But there's a whole range of operational minutiae that currently the states have no idea about. How's the league going to be governed? What is the structure around that? How are the clubs going to be governed?
How are you going to work through all that in 3 months?
Great question. Everyone's waiting with bated breath to understand what that looks like.
So who needs to speak next, the states or Cricket Australia? Cricket Australia.
Yeah, I think it's – I mean, this is a personal view. So my personal view is – it's always up to the vendor to say, here is what is proposed, and then for the people who are either buying to then say, here are our list of diligence questions and how is that going to function. So it has to be coming from the central cricket body as to what they think the best option is. Otherwise you go around in circles all day, every day. And that's leadership, and that is actually what it takes.
Correct. And the states are very, I said a couple of weeks ago, the states never agree on anything, and you quickly picked me up and said, I think we can do this and everything else. I know there's six of them and there's six key stakeholders and they got to try and work it out. I mean, I look at what happened in the 100, for example, and maybe you'll be able to enlighten me a little more there. So in county cricket, there's way more counties or whatever, and they were somehow able to get this competition up and going and worked it out somehow again with a bunch of counties that never ever agree on anything. How were they able to do it with that many stakeholders and we're sort of, it feels like we've got so much hurdles to try and clear before we can do it, and we've got less stakeholders.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's easy to draw the analogy of the 100 and the Big Bash, but they're actually very different propositions. And the reason why is quite simple. And that is the infrastructure around the grounds owned by the counties in many respects. And most of those counties, because of that, had a huge amount of debt. And we're talking hundreds of millions of pounds of debt across county cricket. That doesn't exist currently. All the states are either have some kind of savings in the bank or cash flow positive, minus probably the WACA who have borrowed a bit of money to refurb the ground there. But so that is an example where they were actually forced into this because there was an existential threat to the game as they know it. That doesn't necessarily exist, so that's one thing. Two, the Big Bash is obviously has a richer history, so to speak, 15 years as opposed to three. And so, you know, you've actually got a different, you know, intertwined relationship with the state owners of those teams, as opposed to it's easy to sell something up front and kind of work it out, where something needs to be unraveled, as it is with the Big Bash teams and how they work with the states. Because you can imagine if the Perth Scorchers are sold wholly, what does the Whacker look like as an organisation? So currently, I don't know, maybe there's 100 people there and half are in high performance. What do you need around high performance? What do you need around community cricket? If the main source of revenue is actually going offshore to some Indian owner, how do you structure that organisation from the ground up? So, like, there's a whole range of issues that would have to be worked through because they're so deeply intertwined.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, 100% it does. I mean, it's a fascinating conversation. I got lots more questions, but I'm also conscious I don't want to ask too many and get you in trouble. Do you think it'll happen?
I think at this rate it has to happen.
Right.
I don't know if it will happen this year or next year or the following year. But if I was putting a probability on will the Big Bash teams be privatised in the next 3 years, I would weight that very heavily.
Yeah, but if he's saying, hey, 3 months is the first quarter of this year,
I think that's for a decision to say we're going to sell them and we're going to work towards that in 2028 or it's not, we're putting them up for sale next week.
Is there a problem with delaying it other than we don't get the windfall immediately into the coffers? Like, will it be worth less in 2 years' time or like, or is that just, this is what you deal with every day? You can never really tell, can you?
You can't. You definitely can't predict the future. And Cricket Australia will say the sooner the better, and their advisors will say the sooner the better. There's demand for these teams now and that might go away. I call that BS. The demand for these teams, I think, will actually only increase the longer you hold off for them because of the scarcity around the world of teams that aren't private yet. And so, you know, the real risk actually is that the Big Bash as a product declines in the meantime. And so, you know, then you're kind of dealing with a whole range of issues. So you need some money for that to happen, but I think there are some structural flaws with that could be mopped up pretty quickly.
Yeah, which brings us to the Big Bash today. I mean, I've been on the test circuit clearly, so I've been very heavily in that. And at the end of the day, you're constantly trying to be across all the press conferences and everything else that's going on, and so you can find yourself in a bubble pretty quick. I haven't watched as much of it as what I wanted to, and I don't know if is that the product's not drawing me in? Is it that I've just been busy doing other things? I mean, you're sort of watching a little bit more from afar, Teddy. What have you made of the start to the tournament as we, approach the new year?
I'll kind of hold my line from last week, and I've been pretty uninspired by what I've seen. I've seen two games live. I saw the Sixers play the Thunder. I saw the Sixers play the Stars. I've watched a few on TV. The same problem exists, and that is the big stars aren't here to make you turn your TV on for any length of time. There have been some good games of cricket. The Heat run chase at the Gabba was a ripper. But we know that close games are generally entertaining, and we haven't seen too many of them. Well, all the same things that we've banged on about for years, games starting too late, the big names not being available. I find it actually pretty hard to follow when one team's played four games and another team's played two. And so you're trying to work out who has momentum and who's playing well. And the Renegades have won one and lost one, are on the bottom. And the Stars have played four and won four. And so you actually don't know who's who in the zoo and how that's going to flow through. So I think, and that's hard to do. I'm not saying scheduling in cricket is easy, given around test matches, et cetera, but it doesn't feel like it's popping off as the greatest Big Bash ever. I know the viewership, I think, is up from what I hear. The ground attendance has been okay, depending on where they're playing, but personal view, and maybe because there's a big test series going on, if we were playing New Zealand, I'd be more Bash. And you've only got so many cricket hour watching moments in a day, and I've been choosing to spend it in front of the test match.
Yep. No, I feel very much the same way at this stage of the tournament. Hopefully I'll watch a little bit more in the days ahead now that I've got a bit of unexpected free time.
We're almost halfway through. When you say this stage of the tournament, we're kind of 30% of the way through the tournament. The Stars have played almost half their games.
That's true. Yep. I need to pick it up. I mean, if you look at the table itself, the Stars are 4-0. There's only one other team that is above 500, as we would say in baseball, for example. So that's the Hobart Hurricanes, who are 3-1. And then there's a bunch of other teams that are either, an even record, including the Renegades, as you say, have only played two games somehow at 1-1. The Heat are 2-2. And then there's four sides that have a losing record. So it sort of feels like all of a sudden, that the Stars and the Hurricanes are pulled away up the top, and, the Heat on their day look like they'll be okay. And then everybody else is, trying to put it together with spit and bubble gum at this stage. And the Renegades, who knows? Who knows what they'll possibly be, given we've hardly seen them. Are the Stars the team to beat? I mean, it feels like they've had so many false dawns, haven't they, as a franchise? And firstly, it's nice to see them not languishing down the bottom of the table at this stage of the tournament to begin with. But then secondly, it's, the times that they have been a finalist in the past, they're the ultimate bridesmaid, aren't they? I think they're the only team that have never won a men's big bash. They're the only team that have never won a women's big bash.
I think this year they'll get a crack at it. They're playing pretty good cricket, and the risk in T20 cricket is you play your best cricket at the start of the tournament and not the end. But having said that, momentum is certainly building. They've got a nice list. They're playing well. They're not relying on their big stars, which helps, And they're fielding well. They look well organized and well planned. They're well coached. One thing I do know is, a bit of an unsung hero, but Peter Moores is probably one of the top coaches in the world. Has had a crack at international cricket. Didn't work out, but, coaches knots. They won the county championship last year in the UK. He's a very astute cricket coach. And so, often in T20 cricket, in franchise cricket, that makes a huge difference, because you can set your matchups and your tactics and your players a bit more than you can in test cricket.
Yeah. I saw they won a game the other night, and I looked through the batting lineup. They'd won by, would have been 6 wickets, and the three guys that hadn't had a hit yet were like Maxwell Stoinis and Cartwright.
The they demolished. The Sixers look like Dad's Army at the moment. They're old and slow, and the Stars absolutely gave them a real touch up.
Yeah. Now they've got it sorted. They've got really seemingly all areas covered from the limited stuff I've seen. Interestingly, this is a trend in global cricket. I know Darren Lehman's been a big push for a long period of time to strip the toss, just basically give it to the away captain and go from there. So 6 days ago, to Swamp Thing on Twitter, one of the best stats man going around, put a tweet out basically saying in the last 50 tosses in the Big Bash, 49 times the captain's won the toss and elected to field first. Mm-hmm. So 49-1. And I just did a quick run through before we came on air on the results so far. So out of the 14 games that have been completed, only 4 have been won by the team batting first. So basically, not only is there a huge advantage if you if you win the toss, you get to field and chase runs, and then the results are going your way as well. You're winning 10 out of 14 games. So this, is it as simple as, hey, win the bat flip, all of a sudden, win the game? Is there too much of a correlation, do you think, between what happens at the toss and what happens with the outcome?
Well, that hasn't changed for a while. So, I mean, that is not new. I think if you go through the last couple of big bashes, and maybe we can ask Rick Finlay for this stat on demand, I'd suggest it would probably be pretty close to that. So maybe that's, the predictability for the game. To be successful, you need a little bit more jeopardy and finding nuances in the playing conditions that allow for that. That we're talking about a designated hitter. Maybe there's something else that the game can throw up to make sure that you're not too heavily advantaged, because, predictability is a killer of sport.
Yep. 100%. 100%. Shadab Khan, who was my pre-tournament pick for the player of the tournament, he's going home. So he's out. He's off to play some T20s in Sri Lanka. So unfortunately, he'll be missing for the remainder of the piece.
What, he just decided to do that, or was that always the plan? Or
he got picked in a team for Pakistan and all of a sudden he's off. He hasn't, I don't think he's played for Pakistan recently. And so I don't think he was anticipating on being picked.
Oh, international cricket. Sorry, I thought you
were he's playing in the international team. But there's this rotation policy sort of going on ahead of the World Cup for Pakistan. As we know, some funky stuff happens in Pakistan cricket. No Babar Azam, no Harris Ralph, no Shaheen Shah Afridi. So those three lads are all able to stay and keep playing in the Big Bash. Shadab's got to go and represent Pakistan. And then after all that, they'll put together a T20 World Cup team. And let's be honest, I wouldn't be surprised if all of a sudden the three brand name players that are playing domestic cricket down here all of a sudden find themselves in that 15-man squad for the World Cup in February, March.
Fascinating.
Before we leave the Big Bash, I agreed with you in your comments the other night about the one thing Cricket Australia can do in the short term is send their guys back to play in the BBL. I noticed Bo Webster and Josh Inglis have both been released, so they're going to get a BBL game in ahead of the Sydney Test match. Doesn't sound like any of the other boys, though, are going to play. So just the non-playing members, but at least a couple of them will be going back to have a hit, Teddy.
Well, I'm glad. I get the fast bowlers not having a hit, but would have thought that a few others could do with finding the middle of the bat.
Does that suggest anything about Australia's team, do you think? The fact that Webster's been released to go and play BBL?
Yeah.
He's not playing?
Those two ain't playing. That you can almost guarantee, even the fact that, you know, Todd Murphy hasn't been released suggests that they'll probably play a spinner, for instance, or more of a chance to play a spinner than otherwise. And that will obviously depend on the wicket. And my goodness, isn't the pressure on Adam Lawrence at the SCG this week?
What do you reckon he'll prepare?
I don't know if he knows, to be honest. I think he'll try for something that has pace and bounce and, you know, probably the perfect cricket wicket, which is what they should try and prepare. Just, you know, some movement early on, some good batting for two or three days, and some turn, you know, from day three onwards. Unfortunately, SCG in the past, we've only seen one way or the other. We've seen the effort to do that, and it's too green, and it's, you know, a little chaotic like we did last year. Or we've seen a wicket be low and slow and turn too quickly, and, you know, it's not great for anyone. So the pressure's on. Interestingly, I heard his 2IC, who was, you know, is probably more in charge of the wicket than the overall kind of head curator. He's left. So the pressure.
Right.
Yeah, the pressure's going to be on.
What, in the lead up to this?
I think recently-ish. Enough. Not as in this week, but certainly in the prior weeks.
The forecast, late shower on Sunday, 5 to 10 mil. Then rain Monday, day two, 1 to 5 mil, 90% chance. And then possible shower. So that's the forecast for the first 4 days.
I think they'll overcook it and we're going to get a low, slow, turgid wicket. There you go. There's an early call.
Okay. There we go. The temperatures in the lead up, Teddy, because this is important for curators out there. Mild temperatures, 20, 21, 22, 20, 21 in the 5 days leading into the Sydney test. What do you reckon the Aussies will do? It feels like they're going to play the same sort of top seven, aren't they? Maybe, you know, Todd Murphy gets a look in and they roll out the three quicks. Have you any predictions as to what the Aussie team's going to look like for this last test in Sydney? And as I sort of set up the other day, it is an unusual test where the series is already won. It's the last of the Ashes. Yeah, as Jai Richardson said to me yesterday, 4-1 sounds a lot better than 3-2. I appreciate that. But then they don't play another test match until August. And I imagine people will be sprinting to the front of the queue to make sure they play those games in Darwin and Mackay against Bangladesh, because that will be a great place to play in August on those wickets late in a season, in the top end. So it feels like if you can get a score here, you're going to be an incumbent, and particularly for the four guys in the top seven that need one, that'll be important to make sure they're there to play against Bangladesh.
Yeah, I think the same top seven, Murphy probably plays, and I think Jai Richardson probably misses out. Seeing what I saw last week would be my guess.
So Nisa plays again?
I think I actually think his bowling suits the SCG. You know, you can have the keeper up, he can hit a length. There's some variable you know, it's almost that. Think of the Andrew McDonald role that he played against South Africa, you know, the little off cutters and, you know, the wily medium pacer. It's so of all the wickets, if it isn't, you know, a raging seamer, it probably does suit him.
Pretty clever planning, hasn't it been, for the Bazballs? I mean, they won clearly, but even the whole ploy with Carey up to the stumps, which has been spoken about a lot. Yeah. You've been a big fan of him, but to think that they've bowling coming into this was this felt like a crossroad series for him. That the last time he played an Ashes series in 2023, I think he went 2 for 230 or something, and England were like, right, we can target this guy, we can whack him off his lengths. And all of a sudden the Aussies thought, hang on, we're going to bring Alex Carey up, which, you know, not everyone can do that because not everyone has a wicketkeeper with as tremendous dexterity as what he has. But even Nisa being able to come in, just nibble him around, you got the keeper up, keeps him back in their crease. It's feels like it's a little wrinkle that perhaps England weren't anticipating, and it's kept them pretty honest.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, the athleticism of Carey to do that is remarkable. Yeah.
Just a little hat tip before we get out of here for Brett Lee, who is our latest member of the Australian Cricket Hall of Fame. He had a beautiful chat with Ben Cameron yesterday, which you can hear through the Best of ABC Sport folder in the in any podcast store. So Best of ABC Sport. It's a 16-minute conversation about his career and obviously his path to becoming a Hall of Famer, including he gets asked a real cricket nuffy chat. You'll love this, Teddy, about his little dip in his run-up, the little goose step on the way in as he goes to take off and why he does it. So hats off to Brett Lee. There's something different about the guys that can bowl fast, and he was certainly that.
Yeah, and one of the great people of the game, just a gentleman, great teammate. The spirit of cricket ran deep in his veins. You cannot fault that guy. So a deserved accolade for him. While we are tipping hats, quick shout out to my mate Paul McMahon, who sent me a text. He loves the facts, old Vince McMahon, former employee at the ICC. The England-Australia World Test Championship game, the 150th anniversary, is not for Test Championship points. Okay. I know people have been waiting for that. That was your homework, but evidently you haven't done it.
I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. I actually ran into a Vince yesterday too. I don't know if it's the same Vince.
Different.
He said he was a big fan of the podcast. So shout out to that Vince too, who I ran into at Yarra Park yesterday at the Test Fest. Fan of yours, Teddy, as you can imagine. So loyal listener to the podcast. Ran into many people this week that listen to the podcast. So we always love hearing from people wherever it is, and particularly out and about at the cricket. So thank you to everyone that came up and said they're enjoying the pod every week and the increased cadence, as we like to say in the
The good news is we're going to be face-to-face day one SCG in the media box.
Are you there every day?
Well, I'll be there for the first three days,
Yes.
That's enough.
At this rate, that'll be it. So I'll look forward to seeing you, and we can do that in person on all 3 days. And a little one from the ILT20 last night, just to take us out. I know you're a big ILT20 man. Did you see the opening pair there that put on a handy partnership?
Didn't.
One batter whose initials are MP made 83 off 51, and one batter whose initials are PS made 72 off 56. This was the opening partnership of Michael Pepper and Phil Salt. So the partnership of Pepper and Salt both got away with. Can you believe that? That's actually happened in the game of cricket. Phenomenal.
That's good. I'm glad you left that to the end. So, that's a good
Salt
way to go
and Pepper
out.
As a combination and a batting pair. How about it? All right, that'll do us. I'll chat to you on Friday, Teddy, which will be what day minus two, as the Cricket Australia officials count it. So a couple of days out. We'll preview the Sydney Test in a little bit more depth there, and you can tell us all about that grand old venue. And then I will see you in person, of course, Monday and Friday, and after every day's play right here on the ABC Cricket Podcast.
Later.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.